From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Glenn Close. She stars as Cruella de Vil in the new Disney remake of 101 Dalmatians. Also, Elvis opened for them, the Everly Brothers were inspired by them, the Byrds recorded their music, the Louvin Brothers were one of country music's great vocal harmony duos. We'll meet Charlie Louvin, the surviving brother, who has just re-recorded a lot of Louvin Brothers hits. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Harold Nicholson today pleaded innocent to charges of being a Russian spy. The CIA employee will go on trial next March, and a gag order has been imposed until then. NPR's Paul Miller has more.
Nicholson's lawyers asked for the gag order to stop public statements on the case by government officials. The government says Nicholson, who has worked for the CIA for 16 years, sold the names of CIA agents and other information to the Russians over the last 2 years for $180,000. Nicholson's attorneys claimed law enforcement officials had said a lot more than that, producing what the attorneys called a shocking deluge of prejudicial pretrial comments. Federal Judge James Kacharis approved the gag order. Nicholson's trial will not be held until March, partly because his lawyers have to undergo a security check before they can see documents related to the case. Nicholson pleaded not guilty to the spy charges, and his lawyers have said he will fight the accusations vigorously. I'm Paul Miller in Washington.
There's some progress reported on an accord to withdraw Israeli troops from the West Bank town of Hebron. Israeli officials say they've dropped a demand for written guarantees that would let their troops chase suspects into Palestinian-controlled areas of the city. The demand has been a key sticking point in the talks, but a senior official says Israel already has some rights of pursuit under current accords, and that'll be enough. Palestinian negotiators say Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat still wants written guarantees of an Israeli pullout. American Evan Hunziker is a free man after 3 months of imprisonment in North Korea on spy charges. Congressman Bill Richardson helped secure Hunziker's release. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
Evan Hunziker was accompanied out of North Korea by the New Mexico Democrat who'd negotiated his release and flown to Japan. He arrived at Yokota Air Base outside Tokyo looking healthy but strained. He'd spent 3 months in captivity. Richardson admitted Hunziker had tried to illegally enter North Korea from along the Chinese border, but that he was not a spy, as Pyongyang had charged. His release comes just one day after a North Korean Navyman was returned by South Korea, one of two survivors from the submarine incident in September that represented the most egregious infiltration into the South in decades. Richardson characterized Hunziker's release as a humanitarian gesture meant to signal Pyongyang's intention to make some kind of amends. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
The American Automobile Association says nearly 32 million people will be traveling this holiday weekend, and those who are driving are doing so in spite of gas prices being up about 15 cents per gallon from last Thanksgiving. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is off 27.5 points at 6,500. This is NPR. The government says the nation's economy grew more slowly this past summer than was initially thought. The Commerce Department says during the third quarter of this year, the gross domestic product grew by 2%. That's less than the first estimate of 2.2% offered a month ago. The agency says the revision is linked to a higher trade deficit than originally thought and less inventory buildup. Further, government reports after-tax profits of U.S. corporations fell 2.6% in the third quarter. That's the weakest performance in more than 2 years. A federal judge has ruled that the bulk of lawsuits filed by relatives of those killed in last May's crash of a ValueJet airliner into the Florida Everglades will be heard in state court rather than federal court. Joshua Leves of member station WABE reports.
ValueJet had pointed out that it is a federally licensed airline with operations in several states. Company leaders had hoped to keep the lawsuits in federal court where decisions are often smaller and take longer. But in a decision late yesterday, a U.S. district judge supported the victims' families on court jurisdiction. That could mean especially bad news for ValueJet, since many of the lawsuits come from Florida, a state with a history of multi-million-dollar damage awards. The last couple of weeks have been a mixed bag for ValueJet. They've announced a strong return to business and several new markets, while facing emotional charges from some families of victims during last week's hearing into the crash. ValueJet leaders say it could be March before the company starts to make up the more than $20 million it lost during shutdown. For National Public Radio, I'm Joshua Leves in Atlanta.
The Environmental Protection Agency is expected to announce stricter standards for air quality today. These could require cities to find new ways to control air pollution. Industry had lobbied heavily against the new regulations, saying they were unnecessary and cost way too much. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Disney's big movie for the holiday season, 101 Dalmatians, opened today. It's a live-action remake of the classic animated feature. The role of the villainous Cruella de Vil is played by one of the most respected actresses of her generation, Glenn Close. Her films include Fatal Attraction, The Big Chill, The World According to Garp, Jagged Edge, Dangerous Liaisons, and the TV movie Serving in Silence. She won a Tony for her performance as the faded film star Norma Desmond in the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical Sunset Boulevard. 101 Dalmatians is the story of a newlywed couple and their two lovey Dalmatians who are having puppies. This happy home is threatened by the monstrous fashion plate Cruella de Vil, who has a passion for fur. Spotted Dalmatian fur would be unique. She's determined to buy those Dalmatian pups and turn their coats into her coat.
£500. Oh, £7,500. There. £2 per spot.
Cruella, what would you do with 15 puppies?
Yeah, that's irrelevant, and you can't have any because they're not for sale.
I'm getting very tired of you, Roland.
Roger.
Whatever. Take it! Cruella, the puppies are not for sale.
Yes.
All right. Keep the little beasts. Do what you like with them. Drown them for all I care. You're a fool, Anita. I've no use for fools. You're fired. You're finished. You'll never work in fashion again. I'm through with all of you. I'll get even. Just wait. You'll be sorry. You fools! You idiots!
Glenn Close, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, Cruella de Vil, who you play in 101 Dalmatians, do you see any connection between her and the character of Norma Desmond that you played in the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical of Sunset Boulevard? The character originated
only that
with
we
Betty
wear
Davis,
red yeah. lipstick and mm-hmm. Certain animal fur. I think I actually felt more of a connection between Cruella and the Marquise de Merteuil in Dangerous Liaisons.
Oh, yeah.
I think they are masters of what I call the great game. And they're gleeful in the playing of that game. To me, Norma Desmond was a very, very fragile creature who only could survive on her illusions. And when those illusions were broken, she was destroyed. But Cruella is invincible. Cruella will never be vanquished.
And like the character in Dangerous Liaisons, she sees life as a game too, where you just like manipulate all the characters on the board.
Yes.
For a more
but
favorable
again,
outcome.
Cruella is not as vulnerable even as the Marquise, because Cruella is truly the devil. As she in the original Dodie Smith novelette, which is absolutely charming, she is the devil. Her food is black and tastes of pepper, and that's why she loves to swathe herself in fur, because the hotter she is, the happier she is because of where she comes from.
You were 35 when you had your first film role, The World According to Garp. Had you tried for movies earlier on?
Yes, but not very well. I've never been good at walking into a room as me and convincing somebody that I can play somebody else. I've always been very, very uncomfortable. And I think my career has literally been one evidence of what I can do leading to another. you know. And a lot of times, even when people see you in something, they don't necessarily think you in another kind of role. They fit you into what you've done before.
So had you auditioned for roles but not auditioned well before?
Well, it was a lot of... Yeah, I guess. It's very hard when you're handed two pages out of a 115-page script.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that was rather unfair.
You don't know who you are.
Or the stacking of... Yeah. It's like, you know, if you're lucky. I always never minded if I didn't get cast, if I felt I'd shown them my best. Then I never minded it because I thought, well, you know, you can only do your best. The frustrating thing times is when you're sitting there and you can feel that edge slowly draining out the ends of your fingertips, and it's desperate because it all becomes terribly kind of psychological. And when you feel that you haven't shown your best, that's very difficult. And I must say, I have written letters and asked if I could please come back. And sometimes people let you, and sometimes they don't.
So did you audition for GARP, and did the audition go well?
I auditioned for GARP. And it was very funny, actually, because the description of that character that went out to all the agents was a young Katharine Hepburn type. So I auditioned for George Roy Hill and Marion Dougherty, who was a great, the, kind of the dean of movie casting people. And I literally was kind of talking like Katharine Hepburn. And George said later that it was probably the worst audition he had ever seen. But he'd also seen me in Barnum, and there was something about, he told me later, the stillness that I had on stage and kind of my, I suppose, straight backbone that made him think I could do Jenny Fields.
Fatal Attraction was a role that just really kind of stunned people. This was a role you really went after, I think. This is a role you asked to audition for?
I met with Stanley Jaffe, who's one of the producers, and I remember meeting him in a hotel lobby in New York, and we had tea or something, and I had a little demure kind of summer straw hat on and a loose kind of peasant dress. I couldn't have been more opposite of Alex Forrest, but I had felt very passionately about the character, and I was able to kind of articulate to him the kind of thing that I was thinking about, and I guess that interested him enough to ask that I do a audition with Michael Douglas on video out in California, which I then did, and I thought, I wanted to kill myself afterwards. I thought for sure I hadn't gotten the part.
Why?
Because it was just so, I mean, pleased to walk into a room and there's Michael Douglas and a video camera set up. It's pretty intimidating. And I had long hair at the time, and I didn't know what to wear, so I went to a store and I found this black... a wonderful cotton dress. At that time, it had big shoulders and a very small waist and kind of a great skirt. And I wore that. And then that morning, I didn't know what to do with my hair. I've never been good knowing how to do my own hair. So I just, I'll just let it go wild. I can't deal with it. So my hair was all over the place. I had that black dress on. And then I was so nervous that I took, I think, a half of Valium, which I never do. And I remember kind of weaving across the parking lot to get to the audition and, you know, then go up, there's the camera, there's Adrian Lyne, and what happened, happened.
Now, I know the ending of Fatal Attraction was reshot. You didn't want it to be reshot. And you protested it, but what could you do to protest it when the ending was rewritten?
Just refused to do it. Because I'd grown to really love that character very much. I'd done a lot of research about her, and with psychiatrists, just to understand, first of all, if her behavior was possible, and then when I found out that it was, to then explore what would create behavior like that. And in that research, I really started to love that character. And she was not a psychopath. She was suicidal. She was self-destructive. And the original script was a beautiful, seamless film noir. And they started kind of tinkering with it. We shot the original ending where she kills herself and with the same knife that they've that his fingerprints are on, and he goes off to jail.
So her death frames him.
Yeah, and it was so incredibly upsetting to the American audiences who really like happy endings, and that they reshot it, rewrote it.
So tell me, give me a sense of some of the things you learned from the psychiatrist that really helped you understand the character and figure out how to play her.
Well, in that character, never has a chance to explain to the audience, or the audience never really understands her history or why she's doing what she's doing. So I had to really know myself.
Just for our listeners who haven't seen the movie Fatal Attraction, let me say that your character is a character who basically picks up or helps seduce a married man, and then when he doesn't want to see her anymore, she just goes after him with a vengeance and threatens the safety of the entire family. And becomes,
well, she's also discovered she's pregnant by him.
Right. And the rejection of her sends her into this...
Obsession.
Obsession, yeah. Thank you. Retaliative obsession. Retaliatory obsession. Mm. So back to the insights that psychiatrists gave you that helped you understand this character and helped you play her.
Well, it was a long process. And but, for example, there is a scene where my character sneaks up to their house and looks in the window and sees the parents giving the little girl the pet rabbit. And then she runs away from the window and throws up in the bushes. And I thought, okay. I said, what would cause that? And they said, well, whatever that she would... She sees herself as that child. And the research and, you know, what we had figured out from her behavior, which actually is impeccably written, is that she was a woman who had probably been sexually abused by her father at a very early age. And when looking in that window, she associates herself with that child, and all those subliminal feelings, all that guilt, all that revulsion comes up when she sees the father being so attentive and loving to the child. And that those feelings and the actual physical feelings that she would have gone through as a child through what her father might have, you know, forced her to do makes her throw up.
Now, could you go to the writer of the screenplay and ask him to share these kinds of insights, or would the writer be more unreliable in understanding the psychological motivation?
I didn't, you know, the writer wasn't around much, but, you know, I didn't need to, because with the work I did with a psychiatrist, he had written a pretty seamless case study.
Uh-huh.
In fact, for 3 years after that movie came out, I was asked to speak to the Association of American Psychiatrists at their big meeting. You know, and I said, why? It was just a character I created. I don't know, but it was that real and that... I guess believable for them, and I've been told by a lot of psychiatrists that that part brought a lot of people to their couches.
My guest is Glenn Close. She's now starring in the new version of 101 Dalmatians. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Glenn Close is my guest, and she's now starring in the new version of 101 Dalmatians as Cruella de Vil. I've just gotten in a copy of your father's memoir, A Doctor's Story, and you wrote the introduction to the book. This is the new paperback edition, and he was a surgeon in Africa for many years before moving back to the States, and he, I think, worked on the first outbreak of the Ebola virus.
Yes.
In Zaire. Mm-hmm. And part of his memoir is set at a time of your life that I know has been... a source of a lot of confusion for you, because your father first went to Africa as a member of a group called Moral Rearmament, mm-hmm. which from what I've read and from the way he describes it sounds like part missionary and part cult group.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
And you were, well, he was living in Africa, spending some of the time in Africa and some of the time at a boarding school that I think was run by this group.
No. When he first went to Africa, we were in Switzerland, actually, at one of the headquarters for that group. And we actually went down the mountain every morning to quite a raucous English school filled with, you know, kids from all over the place. That was 2 years. And then after that, I came back to America, and I went into Rosemary Hall, which was in Greenwich, Connecticut at the time.
Did you learn interesting things about your father's motivation for being in this group by reading the book?
Yes, I actually, you know, I kind of put off reading the book. I think I was a little wary of reading it because that was a difficult chapter in our whole family's life. And finally, my mom, who was a magnificent lady, said, "Have you read your dad's book?" And I said, "No." She said, "I think you better read it." And so I read it, and I was very, very moved by it. And I'm very proud of my father. I always have been, actually. He's an extraordinary man. And I think the older I get, the more proud I am of both my parents and what they have tried to achieve in the world and the kind of human beings that they are. And I think every family has, dramas and triumphs and tragedies. And I think my family are a group of very diverse, wonderful people.
And then he left Moral Rearmament after they urged him to stop operating, to stop performing surgery, and basically return to the pulpit. But he says he was determined to follow his own vocation. How did you leave?
Oh, let's see.
I'm assuming that my
the beginning of my the kind of the thing that marked my being able to get out of the grips of that group was when I went to college. And I was a freshman in college when I was 22 years old. And when I went to college, which was William and Mary in Virginia, I made the conscious decision that I would not trust any of my instincts because I felt they had been fed to me. And for that reason, I really started to come alive. I really started to be myself. And one of the first things I did as a freshman was walk into the theater department and audition for the very first play of the season, which was Twelfth Night.
Now, what made you realize at that point in your life, at this point of great transition and great insecurity in a way, that what you wanted to do was act?
I always had wanted to act.
Oh.
Always.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that they never really got me because I always had a sense of what I could do. And I think my dreams probably kept me from being totally brainwashed.
Now, I know you sang for a while with Up With People. Was that connected to...
That was an outcrop of Moral Rearmament. But I think it eventually broke away from it. I've long lost touch with them.
No, I mean, Up With People, as I remember, was just the most kind of square, clean-cut, cheery singing group, a chorus, I guess you could say.
In the 60s.
Yeah. And just as like the world is in this total like chaos of like counterculture and rebellion, like Up With People is really there toeing the line.
Yeah.
Being really, really
freedom isn't free.
Clean cut. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wonder what it was like to have to sing with a smile all the time. I mean, that's my memories of Up With People too. Everybody's
well, I mean,
smiling,
I had no equipment at the time to get out of it. I mean, you know, I had been basically in something like that from the time I was 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you do the best you can with the emotional, spiritual equipment that you have. And I think hopefully we always will be evolving and you know, able to take care of ourselves better and better as we go through life. But I had no equipment. And I was incredibly sincere, but I was very manipulated.
Right.
And so it took a while for me to be able to have the wherewithal to break away. And the thing that helped me break away was thinking to myself, I have to get an education. I am ignorant. I am an ignorant person. I have to go to school. And that was what helped me break away.
So did you break away at about the same time your parents did, or was there any conflict
between you? No, actually, I was in it longer than they were.
Wow.
They were in Africa.
Uh-huh.
Did you I got out of it in 1970, really, when I went to William and Mary.
Did you go through a period of big rebellion after you left?
No, I'd never really been a rebel. But I had terrible dreams. I think a lot of the terrible conflict and anger actually came out in my dreams. For years, I dreamed, first of all, of being totally in their thrall. And slowly in my dreams, I started to, sometimes it was even getting up from a table and walking away, and finally evolved to where I could say, confront them and say, no, you are wrong. And then I didn't have to dream about it anymore. Hmm. But I also had, at the same time, an incredible, joyous discovery of theater. And something which I had always wanted to do. And I think that sustained me and helped me grow.
Now, I heard from somebody, you can tell me if this is true, that you were thinking of doing a film about your father.
No, I wanted to do a film about Ebola.
Oh.
Back in 1987, when David Putnam was head of Columbia, I marched in and said, because of this, you know, discovering it from my dad, I said there was a discovery in 1976 of this, the most deadly virus known to man in Africa, and I want to go back to the mission where it broke out, and I have this means because of my father's, the connections, and he gave me $25,000 to go back to Africa and research it, and I still think it would make a magnificent movie, but Outbreak kind of makes everybody think they know the story, which is absolutely untrue. But in 1987, I went back to Africa, to Zaire, and we, by, you know, just an unbelievable series of circumstances, got ourselves way into Yambuku in the middle of the rainforest and made our way 90 kilometers to the mission. The country now is beyond chaos. Then it was only chaotic. But it was one of the great adventures of my life. And someday maybe the time will come again to tell the story, because it will never not be relevant.
Glenn Close. She's now starring in the new version of 101 Dalmatians. She plays Cruella de Vil. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Cruella de Vil, if she doesn't scare you, no evil thing will. To see her, yes, it take a sudden chill. Cruella, Cruella de Vil, the curl of her lips, the ice in her stare, all innocent children had better beware. She's like a spider waiting for the kill. Look out for Cruella de Vil. At first you think Cruella is a devil.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If I cry when I kiss you, when we say goodbye, don't laugh, don't laugh.
Coming up, the harmonies of the Leuven brothers, who had country music hits in the 50s and 60s. We'll meet the surviving brother, Charlie Leuven, who just re-recorded their biggest hits.
There's no use for me to try. I beg of you, my darling, please don't laugh if I cry. If I say I've always loved you, and I will till I die, don't laugh, don't laugh. Honest, darling, I'm not teasing when I say you are the best. Don't laugh, don't laugh.
know my love will stand the test. Don't laugh, don't laugh. I could never find another, there's no use for me to try. I beg of you, my darling, please don't laugh if I cry. If I say I've always loved you, and I will till I die.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Elvis opened for them. The Everly Brothers were inspired by their harmonies. The Byrds and Emmylou Harris recorded their songs. The Louvin Brothers are considered one of the great vocal harmony duos of country music. They were popular at the Grand Ole Opry and well represented on the country music charts from the late 50s until the mid-60s when the act broke up. Brother Ira was killed in a car accident soon after. Charlie Louvin has continued to record and to perform at the Opry. His new CD, The Longest Train, features songs that he first recorded with his brother.
When I stop dreaming, that's when I'll stop loving you. The worst I've ever been hurt in my life. The first time I ever wanted to die was the night when you told me you loved someone else and asked me if I could forget. When I stop dreaming, that's when I'll stop wanting.
Charlie Louvin with harmonies by Barry and Holly Tashian. I asked Louvin if it was difficult to sing without his brother's harmonies after his brother died.
I'd always believed that any song's worth singing is worth putting harmony on, and of course I had grown used to that for the 23 years that my brother and I had worked together, and even today, 34 years after he's gone, when it comes time for the harmonies to come in, I will move to my left, because my brother and I always just used one microphone. And so you had to share the mic. And I even today, I will move over to the left to give the harmony room, knowing in my mind that there's no harmony standing on my right. But it's just old habits are hard to break.
The harmonies that you created with your brother, I think, were based on the Sacred Harp singing that you used to do in church. Would you describe those kinds of harmonies that come out of Sacred Harp singing, or what's also known as shaped note singing?
I'm not sure, Terry, that I can describe them or explain them where they'd be understood. It's just something, I don't have any musical learning. What I know and what we did is it just came natural for us, because we was raised in a family that went to these sacred harp singings with regularity. There's things that I can't explain to it. They're doing five-part harmonies, and most people today thinks that four is the limit when a quartet sings, that they've got all the parts. But the sacred harp or shape note singing people used five harmonies, and some of them are extremely high with the ladies' parts, and none of them as low as the quartets practice today. It would be like a mid-range bass part.
How did you take the five-part harmonies that you were familiar with from church and adapt that to a two-voice style? What did you use from that? I guess what I'm really asking is, how did you work out your harmonies with your brother?
My brother adapted a harmony that that he thought sounded good, and it was always good enough for me. I remember once our A&R man asked my brother, and that's not, or actually he told him, he said, that's not really tenor you're singing there on that song, is it? And my brother said, what, you don't like it? And he said, I didn't say I didn't like it. I just don't think it's, you know, like regular tenor. My brother said, well, I really don't know what it is. I just thought it sounded good, so I put it in there. And that's kind of the way that we, us being raised together, if it was obvious that the song was going to get too high for me to sing in a certain place, my brother just automatically take that high lead, and I would do the low harmony. We didn't have to step on each other's foot or wink or bump shoulders to do this. It was just something that you knew was going to happen in the song, and you'd go ahead and change to a part that you're capable of doing.
Your early recordings were gospel tunes. Many of them were originals. In fact, why don't we hear one of those originals that you co-wrote with your brother Ira? This was made in 1952, and the song is called The Family Who Prays.
Shall stand. God will say, my good faithful servant, the family who prayed never shall part.
Satan has parted fathers and mothers, filling their hearts with his and hate, heading their pathway down to destruction, leaving their children like orphans to stray.
The family who prays will never be parted.
It's the Leuven Brothers from 1952. Chet Atkins featured on electric guitar?
Yes, Chet recorded our first Capitol record with us, and Chet is a big part of the Leuven Brothers sound from The Family Who Prays right on through to the end of the Leuven Brothers career.
You were singing a lot of gospel songs early in your career, but I know your brother Ira had the reputation of being a heavy drinker and of having quite a temper. Did you share the same religious convictions? Did you live with the same kind of values, or was there a big, big difference there?
No, a lot of us know better, but we don't do better. He knew better. He is extremely well-versed on the good book as far as knowing what was right or wrong. He just wasn't able to conquer the devil, I guess, we didn't have any major problems with the drinking until, I'd say, not end of 1958. The Leuven Brothers records, the sales slowed down as all other country artists did in 1958 because the music was changing. And so our producer told my brother, I believe that it's the mandolin. That's keeping the Leuven Brothers records from selling, which had always been a featured part. My brother worked hard to become proficient on the mandolin. And when this producer, namely Ken Nelson, said this to my brother, and my brother feeling that Mr. Nelson was a close friend and a trusted friend, he believed him. And so he would never play his mandolin again on a recording. After that statement, if it would come up, somebody would say, oh, I think this would sound good with the mandolin. My brother would say, no, I'll let the piano do it or let the guitar do it. Anybody, but I'm not doing it. And it caused him to drink extremely heavy, and he went, between then and the time he passed away, went through three wives and lots and lots of problems that he never could whip.
Did you start losing dates, too? Did he get a reputation for drinking a lot?
Unfortunately, Terry, if you're half of a duet, one person in that duet don't ever get a bad name. It's just the Louvin brothers did this.
Mm-hmm.
The Louvin brothers did that. Anything he did, good, bad, or indifferent, I was in the minds of the promoters and the radio stations and what have you. I was as guilty as he. And no way that I could change that. The only way I could change it would be for us to not to be together. And that finally happened in August 18th, 1963. We had gone from a pretty good career from early the 50s. The song, The Family Who Prays, right on up through our recordings, we had done quite well. And we find ourselves in 1963 on the bottom of the totem pole, playing very few dates. And because promoters, the men who spend the money for the TV ads and the radio ads and the newspaper and rent the building and all this, they don't buy problems. With everything running as smooth as possible, they'll still have enough problems to drive them halfway batty. But if they know that any particular group is more apt to cause them problems than they are to be straight that day, then they just won't buy them. And that's what happened to the Louvin brothers' career.
My guest is Charlie Louvin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Charlie Louvin, his new CD, The Longest Train, features solo versions of songs he first recorded with his brother Ira when they performed as the Louvin Brothers. I want to play another original gospel song that you recorded called I Like the Christian Life. That's really a beautiful song. Graham Parsons loved this song and used it on the Byrds album Sweetheart of the Rodeo. Do you remember writing this?
No, I don't. Things went and come in the Louvin brother career. Sometimes my brother would be a totally good man. He could have been a preacher if he wanted to. He was that knowledgeable of the good book, and he had the gift. But my brother was the gifted songwriter. I came up with the ideas. If I could give him a title and a few words of the story, he could write it in 5 minutes. So this is the way we worked. I don't specifically remember the day that that song was wrote, but I remember that my brother was attempting with all of his might to live a Christian life. So at that time, and the statement was made, I like the Christian life. He thought that might make a song, so what you're about to play is what he got just from that title.
Let's hear it. And this is from Charlie Louvin's new album called The Longest Train.
My buddies tell me that I should have waited. They say I'm missing a whole world of fun. But I am happy and I sing with pride. I like the Christian life. I won't lose a friend by heeding God's call. What is a friend who'd want you to fall? Others find pleasure in things I despise. I like the Christian life.
That's Charlie Louvin from his new album, The Longest Train. Did friends ever mock you for trying to live the Christian life?
No, but I wouldn't say they mocked. When you're not living the Christian life, you have one set of friends. And if you're going to profess to live a Christian life, it's obvious that you're going to have to change friends. You're going to have to change a lot of habits, old habits being hard to break. Sometimes it can't be done. So if you prefer to hang around with your old friends, there's a good chance that you'll drift right back into doing exactly what you are trying to get out of doing.
I know exactly what you're saying. Did your brother have two sets of friends?
Yes. Yes, he did. He had some friends that any time they seen him, wherever it was at, they would have a bottle with them. Always insist, you know, just one. And even if my brother was doing his best to stay straight, to kick it, those friends would always show up, and there wasn't enough of us to keep those kind of friends run off. So they would always get to the artist, and there's other artist that's still big in the business today that has the same problem. One sup will take them right on through two or three fifths in a two-week drunk, you know. So you have to stay away from that first drink.
What was your reaction when you heard I Like the Christian Life performed by the Byrds?
Well, I liked it. It was different. It was lazier. Didn't have the fire in it that the Louvin Brothers had in their arrangement. But I enjoyed it. Graham Parsons also recorded Cash on the Barrelhead. And the biggest favor that that Graham Parsons ever did for the Louvin Brothers is when he introduced Emmylou Harris to the Louvin Brothers sound. He played this song for, I don't know exactly which song it was, but her remark was, "Who is that girl singing the high part?" And Graham said, "That's not a girl, that's Ira Louvin." And so Emmylou did a big favor for the Louvin Brother music catalog. I guess it's about 500 songs in all, and she recorded five or six of them, which I appreciate. I know Ari would have, too.
In fact, I think one of the songs she recorded was If I Could Only Win Your Love.
That was her kickoff song for her career. And I guess she thought a Louvin Brothers song was a good luck charm for her, so she recorded Every Time You Leave, When I Stop Dreaming, and a couple of the gospel songs.
Why don't we hear the Louvin Brothers' 1958 recording of If I Could Only Win Your Love? One of the songs, the song that Emmylou Harris kicked off.
Yeah, it would. As you listen to it, it'd be hard for you to imagine how Emmylou came up with her version. But the young people today and some of the musicians are so great that they can hear an old song and just think up a new arrangement of it immediately.
If I could only win your love, make the most of everything. I'd proudly wear your wedding ring. My heart would never stray one dream away. If I could only win your love, I'd give my all to make it live. You'll never know if I could only win your love. Oh, how can I ever say how I crave your love when you're gone away? Oh, how can I ever show how I burn inside when you hold me tight? If I could only win your love.
That's the Louvin Brothers, recorded in 1958. And that recording is featured on an anthology called The Louvin Brothers, When I Stop Dreaming, that was issued by Razor and Tie. You can hear a little bit of early rock and roll influence on there in the instrumentation.
On which is that?
If I Could Only Win Your Love.
Well, that was 1958.
Right.
You know what the influence was then.
Well, you can hear it on the piano.
Oh, you're not old enough. You're not.
Oh, yes, I am.
Remember Elvis? Are you?
Oh no, not at all, not at all.
No, but we worked a lot of dates on the road with Elvis Presley.
Oh, right. Now, didn't he open for you?
No.
No. Oh. Okay.
No, he was on the bill, as right under many others. But he was on the bill, and they were trying to find out what he was. The people didn't know exactly what he was doing, and I don't think Tom Parker knew exactly what he's doing, but they wanted to try it out. And the people in our audiences was kind of puzzled on this, what this young man was trying to do.
How did you feel about the sexuality in his performances?
Oh, it didn't bother me. My brother worked out a perfect impersonation of Elvis. Elvis is the only man that I'd ever seen that could wear his clothes out from the inside instead of the outside, you know. So it was kind of funny when it was happening. I, like many other people, I thought it was a fad. It was just a fad that people are going through, because I'd seen fads before come and go. And then I visited Elvis's mother, my wife and I did, in Memphis, and I seen ladies as old as my mother and some older on their knees reaching under Elvis Presley's fence just to pull blades of grass so they could take it home and say it came out of Elvis's yard. Then I knew it wasn't a fad.
My guest is Charlie Louvin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Charlie Louvin, his new CD, The Longest Train, features solo versions of songs he first recorded with his brother Ira when they performed as the Louvin Brothers. You and your brother broke up the Louvin Brothers and went your separate ways in 1963, and it was, I think, just about a year later that your brother and his wife were killed in a head-on road collision, and I think it was the driver in the other car that was drinking and that was responsible for the crash. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. It happened in Missouri, halfway mark between Kansas City and St. Louis. My brother was coming home from an engagement that they had been on in Kansas City. And the other two people was going from St. Louis to Kansas City to celebrate Father's Day. They just started celebrating it too early, that's all. They didn't wait till they got out of that car.
How did it change your life when your brother was killed?
Well, I had already become a solo artist, so to speak, Terry, and I had released, or kept a record people had released, I Don't Love You Anymore, which went to the number one spot. And I believe the second song was Think I'll Go Somewhere to Cry Myself to Sleep. It was doing good at the time. And my brother kind of felt that somebody had done him wrong, but I hadn't. Music is the only thing I knew. And so naturally I would try to stay in the business, and because he had sworn to me that he was getting out of the business. However, he was making attempts to get back into business, had a couple of records released for Capitol Records. Neither one of them had done anything, but I'm sure that if he would have been given time, he'd have figured out what the public wanted, and that's what he would have gave them.
You're still performing with the Opry?
Yes, ma'am.
How long has it been?
I'm almost finished with my 42nd year.
Wow.
In February next will be my 42nd anniversary, and I'll start into my 43rd year with the Opry, and I'm really hoping that it'll work into something regular here soon.
Right. How has the Opry changed from when you started singing over 40 years ago in the Opry?
I don't know. There's a lot of beat in the music, but my music hadn't changed. It's just people ask me often, what do you think of the path that country music has taken in the last few years? I say, well, you know, there's a lot of music out there that's called country, but that it's not country. It's even got the public confused. I had a young man walk up to me 3 or 4 months back at a show date I was doing and wanted me to sing a song that was a truly rock and roll song. It was by Lionel Richie. He said, I want you to do this song. And I said, I'm sorry, son, I don't know that song. We're just a country group. We play country music. He said, that's country. I just heard Cousin Sumney play that on my way down here on our local country disc jockey. So, but, you know, you can't fight with people when they say that, because I guess that kid really believed that this song was a country song. So, we'll just have to blame it on the people who promote all kinds of music as country. And it's not the public's fault if they have problems with figuring out what is and what is not country.
Charlie Louvin. The Louvin Brothers hits were re-released on the CD When I Stopped Dreaming on Razor and Tie Records. Here's music from Charlie Louvin's new CD, The Longest Train, on Watermelon Records.
Does the moon shine a little brighter when I hold you a little tighter? Are you wasting my time? Does your love grow a little stronger when I kiss you a little longer? Are you wasting my time? Can I depend on your love to live on? Can I rely on the vows you make? Does your love grow a little stronger when I kiss you a little longer? Are you wasting my time?
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Roberta Shurrock, with Tracy Tannenbaum and Barbara Bogave. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan, too, directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Does your heart feel a little bolder when I cuddle up on your shoulder? Are you wasting my time? Do you melt away when you kiss me? When I go away, do you miss me? Are you wasting my time?
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Borders Books and Music, now featuring Dawn Upshaw's new CD of musical theater songs by Rodgers and Hart on Nonesuch Records. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, TV comedy writer Larry Gelbart remembers his years writing for Sid Caesar and creating the TV series MASH. And as we enter the Christmas shopping season, we talk with TV's most famous salesman, Ron Popeil. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.